Should we dissect lymph nodes when someone has melanoma?
How does moderate alcohol consumption affect the brain?
When people monitor their own cancer symptoms, does that help?
And what's the outcome of small brain aneurysms?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on June 9th, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'm going to turn right to JAMA, and that's because there's two things going on. One is that this week, ASCO, the American Society for Clinical Oncology meeting, a really huge meeting, was taking place, and this was something that was presented there. It's also near and dear to my heart. A study where patients really monitored their own symptoms, and when they found that their symptoms were becoming troublesome, they reached out to a nurse who helped to manage that, and they live longer.
There's really a lot of interest in integrating the electronic patient-reported outcomes, what are called PROs, into the routine practice of oncology for symptom monitoring. But there's really very limited clinical evidence that this actually is beneficial. So that's why this single site study is particularly important. And it was conducted at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York. There were 766 patients who were randomized to either the usual care, they were scheduled to see their doctor at particular times for the treatment of cancer. The other group was randomized into being able to report their symptoms electronically. Those symptoms were reported to a nurse in between visits, and the nurse could decide what to do. And they followed these individuals over a number of years. In fact, until two-thirds of the patients had died. And what they found was there was a significantly better survival in those that were able to report their outcomes and on which that was acted. Specifically, the difference in survival was 31 months versus 26 months.
I think this is really impressive. In some respects, I don't find it terribly surprising because we have seen before that when patients become really engaged and activated in their own care, it's really helpful.
What we need to do now is look under the hood and say, okay, what is it that improved their outcome? Were the nurses able to address complications better? Were they able to adjust chemotherapy better? But it does suggest that when patients take an active role and report their symptoms, is that their outcome may be better.
I like this one. Since we're talking about cancer, let's move to the New England Journal of Medicine. A study taking a look at folks with advanced melanoma and lymph node dissection, whether that actually helps.
When we talk about advanced melanoma, we're talking about people that have had melanoma identified, and then the closest lymph node, that's what's known as the sentinel lymph node, is also positive. There are two thoughts. One is that the lymph nodes act as kind of a filter. It prevents the spread from that region to other regions. The other thought is it's just a marker for the fact that metastasis is already present. Now, if it's the former, if it acts as a barrier, one might hypothesize that once you've identified it, you need to do a complete lymph node dissection. The more distant lymph nodes need to be dissected to prevent it from metastasizing further. If it's just a marker for metastasis that's already present, then doing that complete dissection doesn't really help. And that was the focus of this study. So these are patients that had melanoma, over 1,900 patients, and they had metastasized to the sentinel lymph node. Half of them were randomized to doing a complete lymph node dissection, the other half to just observation. And the primary endpoint was survival related to the melanoma. And what they discovered was that in individuals that had the complete dissection, their survival was no better than those that just had observation. Now, there was a difference in regional reoccurrence, but it didn't affect overall survival. And by the way, there are complications associated with doing the complete dissection. And that's primarily swelling of the limb, what's called lymphedema, which affected as many as a fourth of the patients in whom the complete dissection was done, but only 6% of those in the observation group.
And we know that, of course, lymphedema can be extremely troublesome. Many people report that as a very bothersome and life-compromising kind of a development.
In my opinion, and the opinion of the editorialists who commented on this, it really speaks to the fact that if there is a positive sentinel lymph node, there's really no substantial benefit to the patient of doing a complete dissection once you just do observation. And by the way, if it appears in a more distal lymph node, that can be resected in the future. That happened about 7% of the time in the observation group.
I guess this also just calls into question, for me at least, the academic issue of what do sentinel nodes really tell us?
And I think this gives some information that it's probably a marker that there's more distant metastasis, and doing further lymph node dissection doesn't really improve survival. Good point.
And that's a good thing for patients because, as we discussed, it is pretty troublesome, or at least it can be. Let's turn to this idea that, gosh, if we've identified in your brain vasculature, in your blood vessels, that you have an aneurysm, a small aneurysm, what does that really mean?
And this is becoming more common as we're doing more and more brain scans for various things. And incidentally, we're finding aneurysms, an outpouching of the arteries. And the question is, how dangerous are those? Because we know that they do pose a risk of growing and or rupture. That's more likely to occur based upon how big the aneurysm is, or whether there's a family history of it, or where it's located. But in those small ones, less than 7 millimeters, what's the likelihood it will grow, and what's the likelihood that it will rupture? And the reason why we're concerned about that is in those individuals in whom it ruptures, they develop a bleed that's called a subarachnoid hemorrhage, and the mortality is about 50%. So you'd like to prevent it if possible. Well, to address that, the authors looked at all the literature and they selected the best studies. There was about 26 studies. And what they discovered is that if the aneurysm is small, let's say it's less than 3 millimeters, 0% of those ruptured. If it was 5 millimeters or less than 0.5 ruptured during follow-up. And if it was less than 7 millimeters, it was less than 1%. So these incidentally discovered aneurysms that are really small have a really low risk of rupture.
I'm interested in the actual rate of detection of these aneurysms in people who are getting brain scans for other reasons.
It appears in the literature that about 1 to 3% of individuals that have a brain scan will have an incidentally discovered aneurysm. If you take millions of people across the United States, that's a large number of people. I think that it's important to note that individuals who are considered to be high risk weren't followed with observation. That is, if they had a family history already, if it looked like it was a multilobulated aneurysm, or if they'd already had a subarachnoid hemorrhage, those people were high risk. They weren't followed. They were automatically treated. So we're talking about individuals that don't have any of those high risk features.
How about hypertension or high blood pressure?
That wasn't considered to be a particularly high-risk group. Now, we know that that predisposes to rupture and to increasing aneurysm size, and those people ought to have their blood pressure controlled.
You said that these aneurysms result in subarachnoid hemorrhage. Is that what's always the outcome, or do we sometimes see bleeding elsewhere?
It can be bleeding elsewhere, but it's typically a subarachnoid hemorrhage. It depends on where the aneurysm is located.
Well, that's really interesting. So it sounds like then for those folks who get these incidental findings that they don't need to panic.
I think that's reassuring news.
Now, let us turn to something that is an ongoing controversy. And gosh, it even confronts our personal habits. That's in the British Medical Journal. What happens when we consume alcohol?
There's no equivocation that heavy alcohol abuse is detrimental. With lighter or moderate alcohol use, there's still some controversy. So what these investigators hypothesized was that moderate alcohol use may be detrimental, but light alcohol use would actually be protective. So they looked at 550 men and women, none of whom, by the way, were alcohol dependent. And they followed these individuals for 30 years. They have repetitive cognitive performance testing. At the end of the study, they also did MRI images of the brain, and they correlated that with their alcohol use. And here's what they discovered. Even in an individual with moderate alcohol use, there were MRI changes that suggested functional brain issues, the region that's responsible for things like spatial orientation and long-term memory, was actually atrophied. It was smaller in people that had moderate alcohol use. There was a more rapid decline in some of the executive cognitive function. So moderate alcohol use associated with a decline in cognitive function and MRI changes, light alcohol use was not protective.
And this is so disappointing for those of us who like to indulge in light alcohol use. It seems to run counter to the protective effects we've talked about with regard to cardiovascular outcomes. Still, though, this is an observational study.
It is observational. Again, 30 years in duration. I think it's one of the better done studies. You know, I think what it tells us is that when we talk about alcohol use, we ought to be directing people to be light users, not moderate users. Interestingly enough, in this particular study, a half the men and a quarter of the women in this study were already moderate users when this study was being done. So we probably need to ratchet it down a little bit.
Okay. On that note, I think what I'll talk about on the blog this week is going to be the cancer symptom monitoring and the outcomes. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.